Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year, a report revealed youthful offenders in some North Carolina justice facilities were being locked in small rooms, sometimes for days or weeks on end. Solitary confinement. Then a federal lawsuit was filed by two Charlotte-based attorneys requesting a judge order the state to end that practice. Officially, that practice was ended in 2016 when the state prison system stopped it as part of a broader effort to focus on the mental health, educational, and treatment needs of young people in prison. Officials at prisons where solitary confinement of juveniles continues point to insufficient staffing and administrative challenges. Meanwhile, attorneys filing the lawsuit allege deplorable conditions for young people being confined, from being fed expired milk products to maggots in toilets to a lack of access to required educational opportunities. Rachel Crumpler is a reporter for North Carolina Health News. In her focus on covering gender and prison health, she's been looking into this extensively, and she joins us for the hour along with Jean Casella, director of Solitary Watch. That's a nonprofit watchdog group monitoring solitary confinement and other prison conditions in the United States. And Dr. Craig Haney is with us. He is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, whose research deals with the application of social psychological principles and data with regard to legal and civil rights issues, especially when it comes to people accused of or convicted of committing crimes. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Rachel, I'm going to start with you because according to your latest reporting on this, you say teenagers in North Carolina's juvenile justice system are routinely being locked alone in their rooms for as much as 23 to 24 hours a day. And this comes from a federal lawsuit that I referred to a moment ago, filed by these two Charlotte-based attorneys. Isn't solitary confinement illegal in North Carolina when it comes to young people?
The Department of Public Safety in 2016 publicly announced that they prohibited the practice, so that it was kind of against their policy of doing that. And in this lawsuit, you know, the state has filed a response to those claims by, the lawyers and the three teenage John Does that they're representing. And they stand by that they still do not have a policy or practice of solitary confinement. They deny doing so. Kind of what's at odds is that, you know, the state has admitted that administrative challenges, namely staffing, kind of is preventing some teens from getting out of their rooms as much as, you know, they would like to. So staffing is really at play in how much, they're in their rooms and isolated.
So this lawsuit, which is filed on behalf of three young people aged, 15, 16, and 17, alleges that these kids have not only been locked in solitary confinement-like conditions, but they're also not receiving, quote, quality services, are not in, quote, a humane environment, and are not receiving basic education services. So let's start with that last one, basic education services. That, too, isn't that, too, mandated by law in North Carolina?
Yeah, the state law requires youth detention facilities to provide education services. And, the Department of Public Safety policy is that, you know, it should kind of mirror what these teens would be receiving if they were in public school.
Of course, this case is still in process, but if they're getting around this, how are they getting around it?
I mean, that's what we're still trying to unpack, and what, you know, in the discovery process, those details are coming out. Again, it's a shortage of staff to some degree, where like teachers can be hard to hire. So it's kind of led to, you know, some teens getting more worksheets and things like that, but not actually getting instruction, you know, from a teacher.
So what about the allegations that these young people are not being or not receiving quality services? Once again, that's a quote, are not being held in a humane environment. How do they define quality services? How do they define what is a humane environment?
You know, that's, again, you know, somewhat unclear where, again, the allegations are, you know, some not getting, you know, mental health treatment, or again, the conditions of the room where some, yeah, said there was kind of maggots in the room. So I think, you know, we'd all agree that that isn't humane or what these, you know, teens should experience. But again, the state denies some of those conditions, and they say their facilities, you know, are safe and they are trying to be focused on rehabilitation. But again, based on some of the, you know, allegations from these teens, you know, they dispute that they're being provided that environment.
So you're not the only reporter who in North Carolina who has been looking into this. The Raleigh News and Observer also reports that the lawsuit mentions conditions at Cabarrus Regional Juvenile Detention Center, which is right down the road from where we're sitting right now, and the C.A. Dillon Regional Juvenile Detention Center contends that the isolating practice is happening across the state. It's happening in those two facilities, but they're also saying that it's happening across the state. Have you found that to be the case? Is it isolated to two different facilities, or is it statewide?
It seems to be more statewide. I think there is some variance of the facilities, again, depending, some are better staffed than others. But yeah, I mean, I talked to some attorneys that have clients outside of those two facilities that said, you know, they've been hearing from, you know, their clients that they are staying in the room most of the time. They're not getting out to, you know, have as much rec time, or, you know, it can be in 10-minute periods of a phone call and a shower can be kind of the amount that you get in a day. But some facilities, you know, are doing better than that.
We keep referring to these places as rooms, not as cells. Is that an accurate description? In other words, are youthful offenders put in what we would consider to be a room as opposed to a cell with bars, etc.?
They are, yeah, about a closet-sized room, about 8 by 10 feet, cement, you know, blocking around it. It has a small bed, and a toilet and a sink is kind of what you're looking at.
This lawsuit asks that the state be prohibited from keeping juvenile offenders in their room more than 23 hours a day. Let me ask a basic question. Why is that happening at all? I mean, I understand we're talking about understaffing, et cetera, but it seems, at least to me, and maybe it's not, egregious to be told you cannot leave your room except for 1 hour a day.
I think that's fair, and I think that's where a lot of people line up. Even the state themselves, you know, said in the lawsuit filing that they recognize the harms of solitary confinement, that it does do physical and mental, you know, health ramifications. So I think everybody is kind of in agreement that isolation in one's room, cell, you know, is harmful. And again, the juvenile justice system, I think, is really key in that it's, you know, supposed to be focused on rehabilitation, because these are, you know, youthful offenders, teenagers that have, you know, their life ahead of them. So we're trying to focus on rehabilitation, and the programming, you know, time outside of a room is kind of where that rehabilitation happens.
So to be clear, these young people who are allegedly being confined up to 23 hours a day, who are being denied quality health service, quality services, who are being denied access to education, these are not necessarily young people who have become difficult to control or are dangerous to themselves or others. It's just that it's more convenient, it's easier for prison officials who are understaffed to deal with it this way. Is that the crux of it all?
To a degree, I think that is the issue here, is that basically the state, there's two kind of categories we're looking at here. Administrative room confinement, which is basically, you know, a teenager's put, you know, in their room, and, you know, locked there for what could be, 23 to 24 hours, but it has nothing to do with their behavior. It's, you know, in part driven by staffing. You don't have those legally mandated ratios. Or the other category is temporary room confinement, which is where that's where behavior issues come up. Or if there's an infraction of, you know, passing notes or contraband, you could be put, you know, in a room and locked there for a period of time to deal with behavior issues.
So a couple of years ago, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden decided to close the juvenile detention facility here, which meant that any juveniles charged with crimes awaiting trial, et cetera, had to be transferred to other facilities around the state. And one of those facilities was the one in Cabarrus County that's part of this lawsuit. Has the transfer of Mecklenburg County's youthful offenders or alleged youthful offenders exacerbated the problem in Cabarrus County?
I think you bring up a really key point, and that's why this story is relevant to, you know, Mecklenburg quite a bit, is because, yeah, the majority of those youthful offenders that were at the county-operated Mecklenburg Juvenile Detention Center went to this Cabarrus facility that's now the focus of the lawsuit. And yeah, the Mecklenburg County Juvenile Detention Center was the largest in the state. It had 72 beds. So then when that facility closed rather suddenly, the state had to look at where to send these people. And it led to overcrowding that, you know, is still a problem, and which is some of this capacity administrative issues we're seeing that's leading to some of this prolonged isolation.
So in just a second, we're going to meet Jean Casella. She's the director of Solitary Watch, Rachel, and they report that, quote, far from being a last resort measure reserved for the worst of the worst, solitary confinement has become a control strategy of first resort in many prisons and jails. They are writing about adult prisons here, I believe, but is that also the rationale for using it on youthful offenders in North Carolina? Rachel.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were
okay.
Passing
That's
that
right.
to Jean. Yeah, I mean, can you repeat the question? I'm sorry. I thought you were directing that
okay,
to her.
That's all right. The fact that it's far from being a last resort, it's the strategy of first resort in many prisons around the country, and that's adult prisons. Is that part of the strategy in North Carolina for youthful offenders, or is it strictly what we've been talking about, challenges with staffing, et cetera?
No, I think there's another layer of a lot of the attorneys I spoke with, you know, pointed out that COVID was kind of this turning point with isolation, where, again, you know, during COVID, teens were locked in the room, prisons too, adults. Like, this happened in prisons and juvenile detention facilities across the United States, where, yeah, you had to be locked kind of as this public health measure to stop the spread of infection. And even after that subsided, you know, attorneys kind of point to, like, it seemed like there was this cultural shift where they got used to or normalized to the practice of, yeah, teens were just kind of locked in their room. And that is what attorneys say or told me, you know, we're still trying to work through, is this kind of normalized adjustment to kids being left in their room.
So this is not unlike the challenge that many companies face. They all went virtual during the pandemic, and it's hard to get the employees to come back to the office. Is that essentially we've moved to this paradigm that was created during the pandemic, and it's just hard to get out of it, to break the inertia of that? Is that what's going on here too, part of it?
I think that's part of what kind of kept coming up, of it was kind of this perfect storm of, yeah, COVID kind of led to this cultural shift of isolation being normalized, staffing being an issue that really got tough during the pandemic.
Rachel Crumler is a reporter for North Carolina Health News. She's reporting on this locally. We'll widen the discussion when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the practice of solitary confinement of juvenile inmates within North Carolina, based in large part on a story that Rachel Crumpler has been reporting for North Carolina Health News through Report for America. We're going to widen this discussion out to see how prevalent this kind of treatment is nationwide and the effects of this kind of treatment on young people. Jean Casella is also with us. She is the director of Solitary Watch, and Dr. Craig Haney is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Jean, I should point out that the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, which runs these facilities that we have been talking about in the first segment, has categorically denied the claims made in this lawsuit, including denying that there is any policy or practice of regular solitary confinement. But in your work as director of the prison watchdog group Solitary Watch, is solitary confinement of young people, young offenders, a common practice around the country, or are we, in fact, an outlier if it is occurring here?
It is a common practice around the country, and I think a good place to start is to talk about how fond the criminal justice system is of euphemisms. And calling solitary confinement room confinement when it's used against young people is at the top of that list of euphemisms. When Rachel described the rooms, so-called rooms, that these children are locked in, they sounded exactly like adult prison cells to me. Concrete, 8x10 concrete boxes with a bed and possibly a toilet. That sounds like a prison cell to me. And the idea that kids, another thing is we call them juveniles or youthful offenders. That's another euphemism. These people are children or kids. And I think that other kind of terminology makes it easier to dehumanize them and, assume that they are somehow less deserving of their basic human rights.
The three young people in this lawsuit in North Carolina are age 15, 16, and 17. And you're right, a 15-year-old is a child. They are not an adult, although they are trying in North Carolina to raise the age of what constitutes adult who commits an infraction. But at 15, what kind, around the country, at 15, what kind of trouble do you have to get into to be put in one of these places?
I think there's a very wide array of, crimes that could send somebody to a juvenile justice facility, from, causing trouble at school to much more serious and violent crimes, but they don't necessarily need to be violent crimes. And I do have some stats on how many kids are experienced solitary confinement nationwide. This is from the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. About 60,000 kids are in juvenile facilities, and of those, 35% experience solitary confinement for a day or more. And the recommendation from child advocates is that kids be placed in room confinement or isolated for no more than 4 hours at a time. So we're talking about, days or weeks. That's completely outside of the scope of what's healthy for a young person.
You run an organization whose name is Solitary Watch. It's dedicated to watching out for people who have been confined to solitary confinement, which indicates that the practice is large enough nationwide to warrant an organization like yours to keep their eyes on this. Is it fundamentally a practice for adult inmates? Are youthful offenders a small subset of this? And are most of the adult inmates who are in solitary confinement there because they are a danger to themselves or others, or are there other reasons for them being in those conditions?
As you so kindly quoted from our website, solitary is a control measure of first resort. Someone can be sent to solitary for disobeying a direct order, which can be something as simple as getting out of line in the mess hall. They can be sent there for cursing, for smoking cigarettes, for having any kind of contraband, which includes not only weapons and drugs, but one example I use is too many postage stamps. People have been sent to solitary for having too many postage stamps. So it is the disciplinary measure of first resort in many prisons and jails. And our figure that we came up with, and this is again based on federal numbers from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, is 122,000 people in solitary confinement at last count in
Wow.
prisons and jails. Those numbers are from 2019.
And you say those numbers are notoriously difficult to get to determine because of the opaqueness, I guess, of the prison system in the United States. Why are they so hard to get? Why don't they just publish them?
Because there is no national requirement that that prison systems even keep track of who they're putting in solitary confinement for what reasons or how long. Many systems do track them and they report them to the Bureau of Justice Statistics when asked, but that only happens about every 5 years. Prisons and jails in general and solitary confinement units in particular are also notoriously off limits to the public and to the media, which is why the kind of reporting that Rachel is doing is so important. It's also why the kind of lawsuit that we're talking about today is so important, because it gives some access to these, kind of off-limits locations.
As we're going to hear in the course of this program, there are long-term effects of this. And so let me bring in Dr. Craig Haney. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. You say, Dr. Haney, that confining prisoners in a cell for 22, 23, 24 hours a day is tantamount to torture. And you point out that solitary confinement is one of the tried and true devices that torturers worldwide engage in, and that torturers recognize the impact of this kind of treatment. So, what does it do to people?
Well, I've been studying this for since the late 1980s, and along with a lot of other researchers and experts, I can tell you that solitary confinement is not only painful, but it's damaging and it's dangerous. It's been compared to torture because it has a profound psychological and now we know physical effect on people who are subjected to it. It leads to depression, it leads to social anxiety. It leads to disorientation and sometimes even exacerbates symptoms of psychosis. Solitary confinement units are units in prison and jail systems where the very highest rate of suicide and self-harm occurs because of the overwhelming nature of the experience. It is profoundly damaging to people. Even in the short term, it is. We now know especially damaging to young people because of the neurological, emotional, psychological, and cognitive immaturity. You're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-old children, really, who are still in the process of developing both neurologically, but also in a psychological sense, who they will become. And when they are subject to the kinds of trauma that people experience when they're in solitary confinement units, they are especially vulnerable to damage.
You say that where this is used as torture, the torturers know the impact of this on people. Among those impacts are the fact that solitary confinement destabilizes people. It makes them vulnerable to manipulation. It puts them at the precipice of madness. If torturers know this, we don't.
Well, we do know it, and it's been extremely well documented. And when I first started doing this research, there was not a whole lot of research available on it. In the 30 or so years since these early studies were published, a wealth of information, all pointing in the same direction, has documented the harmful effects. I think in moments of candor, prison systems, prison administrators will tell you they do this not because they believe it's not harmful, but because, as Jean said earlier, it is one of the ways that they have to control a prisoner population. Is it an expedient response rather than a humane response? And it is done in spite of the fact that people know it is harmful, not because they believe it isn't harmful.
As part of your research, you interviewed a group of inmates who had spent time in solitary confinement at the Pelican Bay State Prison in California in 1993. This, I think even people on the East Coast have heard about Pelican Bay because it is a, the stories there are legend. But anyway, they were in prison. You talked about them being in solitary confinement back in 1993, and you returned 20 years later to discover that some of these same prisoners were still being held in that condition. And you note that those men underwent what you call social death. 20 years in solitary, two decades. Do we have any idea what the tipping point might be for somebody to suffer this way? In other words, does it take a week? Does it take a month? Does it take 10 years, 20 years for them to suffer this social death that you talk about?
Well, I think it takes a different amount of time for different people. Certainly after 20 years, virtually everybody who was exposed to that painful, damaging experience was profoundly transformed. And they recognized that. Part of the interviews that I did with them revealed the fact that they had come to terms with and understood that they were never going to be social beings again, that they had been robbed of any ability to connect in a fully meaningful way with other people, because they had been forced to live for decades in the absence of meaningful human contact. That's an extreme case, but we also know that people experience profound transformations almost immediately. There is a phenomenon known as isolation panic. Sometimes people are overcome with anxiety in the first few hours of being in solitary confinement. A period of vulnerability with respect to suicide and self-harm is in that initial period of isolation, when people are confronted with the fact that they are locked alone in a cell. They don't know when they're going to get out. They don't know when they're going to have meaningful human contact with someone again. And for some people, the anxiety overwhelms them. And some people, in some cases, are so overwhelmed by this experience that they begin self-harming, or they begin to contemplate taking their own lives because the experience is intolerable. So it varies for different people over different periods of time.
Solitary confinement has been a practice that's been used probably since the beginning of incarceration, hundreds, decades, centuries ago. And perhaps we didn't recognize the impact of it psychologically on people, maybe until you did your studies, Dr. Haney. But in your studies of this, now that we know it, is the intent of this punishment to do psychological damage, or is it simply an unintended consequence? And if we know that this is what happens, can it be an unintended consequence?
Well, ironically, we've always known solitary confinement was harmful. It was used widely in the 19th century in this country, and it was abandoned as a widespread practice precisely because it was understood that it tended to drive people crazy. And there are documented not just psychological studies, but even legal cases in which this was acknowledged. We returned to it in the early years of the era of mass incarceration in the 1980s and 1990s, as I said earlier, largely as an expedient. We had large numbers of people. Prison systems didn't really know how to control them. Prisons were overcrowded. They resorted to this old, tried and true and yet inhumane practice. I think perhaps initially as an expedient, but once they began to do it and in fact build prisons around the concept of isolation, it became increasingly widespread and harder for prison systems to relinquish. In some instances, I think it is done to break people. In other instances, I think it is done because prison systems have not developed alternatives to solitary confinement. So they do it because it's there. They do it because they haven't thought their way through other ways of dealing with prisoners who may be harmful to themselves or others. Prisons are bound by inertia. There's not a lot of creative thinking that goes on in prison systems in the United States. And so if solitary confinement is the way that you deal with disciplinary infractions, or one thing we haven't talked about is the high concentration of people who are in solitary confinement who are profoundly mentally ill. In any prison system, the highest percentage of people who are mentally ill are in solitary confinement units. This applies to juveniles as well. And obviously, persons who are mentally ill are even more vulnerable than the normal population to the harms of solitary
confinement. Are those people in solitary confinement because it's safer to put them there for themselves and other inmates, or is it because that they actually belong in a psychiatric facility and they need the kind of help that prisons cannot provide?
Well, the answer is both. In some instances, people are put there as a temporary response to perhaps a psychotic break or an instance of suicidality. But as we were talking earlier, the longer somebody is there, the more harmful the experience is. So it can only be a short-term response to an emergency situation. And after a short period of time, people who are mentally ill, of course, need to be transferred to a mental health facility. There are lots and lots of mentally ill people who are languishing in solitary confinement because prison systems lack alternative placements for people who are mentally ill. There is no reason to believe someone who is mentally ill is going to get better while they're in solitary confinement. So the only thing that can be happening to them is that they can be kept temporarily safe, physically safe, but at the expense of the psychological harm which is being done to them because of the isolation.
Gene Robert Lindham, who's one of the attorneys who filed the suit here in North Carolina, says, quote, holding children who have not even had their cases adjudicated by a court yet are in solitary confinement for 23 to 24 hours a day in a cell is unconstitutional, plain and simple. But William Lassiter, who is deputy secretary of the state's Division of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, says this happens because of staffing shortages and that he doesn't consider the practice solitary confinement, quote, since it isn't being used as a punishment and young people aren't being held in an isolated unit. Is he splitting hairs here?
I think it's even more shocking that they're talking about putting kids in cells for 23 hours a day for what are basically bureaucratic reasons. I mean, there would be really no excuse if it were punishment, but to be somehow excusing it because it's just about staffing shortages. And by the way, I want to say that staffing shortages is a real problem throughout juvenile and adult facilities across the country, but it's also another way of saying there are too many people in these facilities. There are too many people being held there. I mean, if we can't treat them on a basic level of human rights, then they shouldn't be there, and and kids should be cared for in the community as much as possible and not in these facilities at all.
Gene Casella is director of Solitary Watch. It's an organization that keeps an eye out for what's going on around the country in prisons with regard to solitary confinement. She's here with Dr. Craig Haney from UCAL and Rachel Crumpler. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about solitary confinement, particularly when it comes to juvenile offenders within North Carolina, a story extensively reported on by one of our guests today, Rachel Crumpler, who reports for North Carolina Health News under the auspices of Report for America. Gene Casella is also with us, director of Solitary Watch, and Dr. Craig Haney, professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Gene's organization, Rachel, Solitary Watch, says solitary confinement is especially common among children throughout the United States who are being held in adult prisons. But in North Carolina, they are not being held in adult prisons. They're in correctional facilities designed for young offenders. And the problem here, as we've talked about, is a lack of staffing. How many more staff members would the system need in order to not exercise this practice? Do we know?
So I don't know the total raw number, but as far as percentages, the staffing situation, again, got historically grim. Staffing levels plunged during the pandemic. And over the past couple of years, they have made some small inroads to get additional staffing. So right now, overall, the division that operates these juvenile detention facilities has a 24% vacancy rate overall. But kind of the direct care position, so the people working, you know, day to day inside these facilities, kind of monitoring movements and getting them out of their cells, providing programming, those range around more of the 30 to 40% range. Those are the highest level of vacancy rates.
Is the vacancy rate because people just don't want these jobs, or is it because they don't pay enough?
The pay. The pay is what the state points to, and they know they don't offer enough pay. The starting pay is around $37,000 for a position at these facilities, and it is a tough job. You're working, you know, with youth, and you're trying to provide services, but it's a tough job, and you can go to Costco, Target, and work and get paid more money. So they, one of their highest priorities, they told me, is, again, providing more pay. But in 2023, actually, that 37,000 number I just said, that was a result of some raises that were implemented in October 2023, which is why staffing has improved slightly over the last year.
So we've talked about the prevalence of this, Dr. Haney. We've talked about some of the psychological impacts of this. But you point out that we have to remember that the overwhelming majority of prisoners will be released one day. And it should matter to all of us, you say, the state of mind that they are in when they rejoin society. Are the psychological impacts of solitary confinement exacerbated by the age of the offender? In other words, are you more likely to come out of solitary confinement as a youthful offender being more dangerous than perhaps an adult, or does it even matter?
Well, it matters a great deal. It matters a great deal. In fact, it matters so much that the American Psychological Association last year adopted a set of standards that was created by a group of psychologists, myself included, prohibiting the use of solitary confinement for juveniles precisely because of their psychological vulnerability. And the issue isn't so much whether or not people are more dangerous when they come out of solitary confinement and are released into the community. It's whether they're able to function at all. Solitary confinement impacts people's ability to function in a normal, healthy way. It has psychological impacts in terms of depression, in terms of social anxiety, both of which things would impair a person's ability to reintegrate in a normal, healthy way back into society, to create relationships with other people, to get a job, to find a place to live. It also, if people have pre-existing mental health conditions, then they come out with those conditions exacerbated. So they're coming out with more serious mental health problems than they entered either an adult or a juvenile institution. So we're talking about whether or not people can reintegrate back into society. Some of those people will go on to commit crimes because they can't adequately reintegrate. Right. But it's not so much that they're made dangerous by solitary confinement. It is that they are made more dysfunctional, if you will.
So if we consider that one of the reasons for confinement is rehabilitation, we are setting these people up to fail when they are released.
Without question.
Rachel, in addition to damage to a person's mental health, you report there are physical health risks to solitary confinement, including the risk of higher risk of self-harm, even suicide and or attempted suicide. Do we have any figures on the number of young people in our system in North Carolina who have experienced physical harm from this?
I do not have those metrics, and they're not public. I will say, you know, about 2,900 juveniles go through our detention centers every year. Or that was from like 2023. So this, we're talking about, you know, almost 3,000 kids that go through this system every year.
So, Gene, getting back to the idea, well, prison is for punishment. Prison allegedly is for rehabilitation. It's for getting people ready to come back into society in a safe and sane manner. And if that's the case, it would seem that solitary confinement, on the face of it, is at cross purposes with those intents. Would that be accurate?
It would, and I'm really glad you bring this up, because, you know, we have been talking about the inhumane nature of solitary, the damage that it does to the individual human being, but we haven't talked as much about the damage that it does to public safety and even prison safety. Not only is solitary inhumane, but it also actually doesn't work for the purposes that it is supposedly designed for. We now fortunately have some examples of prison systems that have dramatically reduced their solitary populations, and the truth is that violence actually is decreased once the use of solitary confinement is decreased. So solitary does not make prison safer, and certainly it doesn't make the public safer because, as Craig said, 95% of people in prison, even with our very long sentences in this country, 95% of people will come back and walk among us in the community. And for them to be damaged in this profound way is not beneficial to public safety.
Craig, you nodded your head in recognition when Gene was talking about the fact that violence decreases in the absence of solitary confinement. Expand on that.
Well, the corrections administrators have justified the use of solitary confinement in the name of prison security or safety within the institution. There have been numerous studies which have shown that that simply is a false claim. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the use of solitary confinement reduces violence or repeated disciplinary infractions in prison, and certainly no evidence that it has a positive effect on people when they get out. And in fact, as Jean suggested, there are some programs, I've been involved in some of them, where we've reduced the prison system's dependence on solitary confinement and been able to demonstrate that, as Jean said, not only does the disciplinary infractions and rates of violence not go up, they actually decrease. Solitary confinement is dysfunctional for the people who are placed in it. It's dysfunctional for the prison system. And interestingly enough, it's also dysfunctional for the people who work in these units. You think for a moment about what it is like to work in a unit where people are confined virtually around the clock in their cells. It's a stressful environment, of course, for the people who are confined in their cells, but it's also a stressful environment to work in for the people who have to oversee these kinds of units where so much suffering is taking place, where people are not given any opportunities for programming, for rehabilitative services, for even moments of meaningful human social contact. So it's a profoundly bad practice on multiple dimensions.
Rachel, you report that North Carolina's juvenile justice system is designed and intended to be more rehabilitative than punitive. But if you lock people up for 23 to 24 hours a day, if they have a lack of good nutrition, because some of these inmates, young inmates, have been alleging that they're being fed expired milk products and other food that you wouldn't want to consume, that they're living in poor sanitary conditions, that they're being denied educational opportunities that in North Carolina at least are required by law. How can this possibly be rehabilitative? Does the prison system recognize the incongruity of that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a contradiction with all this, which I think the other experts have really laid out why that's at tension. Because again, if you really want to set up a youth to be, quote, rehabilitated or successful when they are released back into the community, again, if they sustain lasting harm from being isolated in their room, which is likely bound to happen, in which these John Does that are, at the center of this lawsuit kind of outline, it's just counterintuitive. And again, the state did, in their response, admit and recognize that they've seen this research. They know it is harmful. Kind of what's at dispute is they say they do not, they kind of dispute the length of time that teenagers are kind of kept in their room.
And the lawsuit that you report on here alleges that these children, quote, have suffered immense physical, social, and psychological harm from solitary confinement. Aside from the broad strokes that we've been talking about, do they go into any great detail in that lawsuit about what exactly these young people have suffered?
I mean, one of the John Does kind of gave a statement in one of the court filings, and he said, like, sometimes I just basically scream in my cell. You know, that was kind of telling where, again, that's kind of the emotional toll that solitary can take on young folks. And, you know, he said, you know, other youth are kind of having that same experience where, you know, he's heard, you know, banging on the cell doors because they just want to get out. And, you know, that experience of being isolated in his room, you know, just made him mad and frustrated. So really, there is a toll. Yeah.
The lawsuit does say that at this 62-bed facility at Cabarrus Regional Juvenile Detention, children are locked in small rooms. We've talked about that. And if they take more than 10 minutes to shower, the suit alleges, they have to shower the next day in their sink. That they are allowed out of their cells for a shower, and they have 30 minutes of recreation twice a week. Some don't have mattresses on these beds, which are, I guess, metal or concrete beds. Have you been able to corroborate those allegations?
The state, I will say, denies, you know, those specific details of it. You know, that's what the lawsuit outlines. You know, that's what they say happened, and kind of the sworn testimony is what those teens say their experience was. So we have a bit of a conflicting narrative. But yeah, some other lawyers just talked about, you know, having other youth not affiliated with this lawsuit kind of have some of the same conditions.
Well, let's talk about that, because as we said, the North Carolina Department of Public Safety has categorically denied the claims made in this lawsuit, including denying that there is any policy or practice of regular solitary confinement. And according to your reporting, they also assert that juveniles do have the opportunity to participate in recreational activity and education programming outside of their room. Could it be that officials, juvenile detention officials around the state are ignorant of what is happening, unaware of what is happening at the Cabarrus Regional Juvenile Detention Center or the C.A. Dillon Regional Juvenile Detention Center? Could it be that they just don't know?
I don't know, you know, their mindset of it. But again, through this lawsuit, there has been exchanging of information where records are being exchanged of what is happening. I will even say, you know, to the staffing point, it was so strained with staffing that Secretary Lassiter, who oversees all of these facilities, had to picked up shifts working, and so did other head leaderships. That's how dire it was. But again, what's consistent among my, you know, sources that I talked to of these lawyers and advocates, you know, the system is under strain. Everybody kind of gets that. But overcrowding and this understaffing, you know, is a bad mix, but that can't be, those consequences can't be passed on to the kids, which is kind of what's happening. So it's like, how do we figure out how to get this better? Because we are at kind of at a strained system.
Gene, Donald Trump has big plans for reshaping the government as we know it and transforming policies and practices that have been in place at many levels for a long time. Your organization says that if, quote, Donald Trump's rhetoric translates into action, and we should believe that it will, we need to be prepared for growing federal prison and jail populations and a parallel increase in the number of people in solitary confinement by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Why?
Well, we don't have to guess about this. We actually have evidence from the first Donald Trump administration that within the federal prison system, which he has the most influence over, the use of solitary confinement did increase over 10% of the total federal prison population. So I think we can expect to see increases again. I think in general, the sort of law and order approach leads to higher prison populations. And as Craig said, overpopulation in our prisons is a primary reason why solitary confinement is so liberally used.
Craig, I have less than a minute left. You have said that we're not sure that anyone goes through solitary confinement without having been changed in significant ways, but the damage may not be apparent. Explain that.
Well, the damage is oftentimes internal. And it's manifested, ironically, oftentimes when people come out of solitary confinement. People were forced to live in the absence of other people, and they deteriorate in the face of isolation. And it's when they're required to come back into a social world to develop relationships, to get jobs, to function meaningfully around other people, that the cost, the psychological cost, the damage, it becomes manifested and they face difficulties that they can't overcome.
Rachel, in 10 seconds or less, where does this North Carolina lawsuit stand?
It's going to be a month-long journey. I mean, we won't know. Documents will still be exchanged, but we're going to have to see what happens, and it'll go into the next year.
Rachel Crumpler's been reporting on this extensively for North Carolina Health News through Report for America. Jean Casella is director of Solitary Watch, and Dr. Craig Haney is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.